Hello and welcome to Science World. After months of disturbing news about the spread of Ebola in West Africa, Lisa Schlein tells us that the World Health Organization provided a glimmer of hope this week. The number of newly reported cases of the deadly virus in Liberia is beginning to decline. Well, one of two International Space Station resupply missions scheduled for this past week actually made it to the space station. The U.S. rocket exploded shortly after launch, but the Russian supply spacecraft, launched a few hours later, made it safely to the ISS. And today on our one-on-one segment, since it's time change weekend here in the U.S., we'll talk about the history and science of timekeeping and discuss whether the biannual time changes should be kept or eliminated. We'll have these stories and more on today's edition of VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. On Wednesday, a senior official at the World Health Organization said the number of newly reported cases of Ebola in the worst affected country, Liberia, is beginning to decline. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
After months of near futile battle with Ebola, a glimmer of hope is beginning to emerge in the worst affected country, Liberia. WHO Assistant Director General Bruce Aylward says he is cautiously optimistic that the tide may be turning. He says the Liberian government is mounting a multi-pronged investigation to determine whether the decline in Ebola cases is real.
So far, based on the information received today, it appears that the trend is real in Liberia, and there may indeed be a slowing of the epidemic there. The government, again, is looking at that information and will come out, I believe, more definitively in the coming days. The big concern, of course, is that that information would be attributed to the wrong factors, number one, and then misunderstood in terms of the implications for getting the job finished here.
Liberia has been struggling to get this deadly disease under control for several months. Dr. Aylward says it is likely that some of the measures the government and aid agencies have been pushing are beginning to bear fruit. He says there has been a huge effort to inform the population about how Ebola is transmitted in order to get people to change the behaviors that are putting them at risk. Most notably, he says, safe burial practices are being more widely adopted. Dr. Aylward says progress is being made in trying to build up clinical care and treatment capacity. He says WHO and partners are aiming to get 56 Ebola treatment centers with a capacity of 4,700 beds up and running as soon as possible across Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. He says 15 of these centers are in place, so there still is a long way to go. He says hundreds of doctors and healthcare staff are needed to minister to the patients. Aylward says this is very important, as it has been shown that people who are quickly isolated in treatment centers have a better chance of survival. The current mortality rate in Liberia is around 70%. While some positive movements can be seen, Dr. Aylward warns the Ebola epidemic is far from over.
To the question of, you know, am I hopeful? I'm terrified, you know, that the information would be misinterpreted and that people would start to think, oh, great, this is under control. Ebola is, that's like saying, your pet tiger is under control or something. This is a very, very dangerous disease. Any transmission chains in any area can rapidly result through a couple of dangerous events in many, many more cases.
The WHO Assistant Director General says there is increasing evidence that Ebola-affected countries can get on top of this disease and can turn the trends around. But he adds, they need further help to succeed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Wednesday's successful launch of a Russian space vehicle taking supplies to the International Space Station was in sharp contrast to the explosion of a private U.S. cargo spacecraft shortly after its Tuesday launch on a similar mission. George Putich has more.
Five, Under a $1.9 billion contract with NASA, Orbital Sciences Corporation, based in Virginia, has sent two cargo vehicles to the International Space Station without a hitch. This time, the Cygnus spacecraft, powered by an Antares rocket, was carrying more than 2 tons of water and food and also some classified equipment. But several seconds after the launch, the rocket blew up before the new second stage motor was able to ignite. The explosion completely destroyed the cargo and damaged the launch pad, but no injuries or loss of life were reported. At a press conference at Wallops Island Launch Facility, Executive Vice President and General Manager at Orbital Sciences Corporation, Frank Culbertson, said the Antares program will be put on hold.
We will not fly until we understand the root cause and the corrective action necessary to ensure this doesn't happen again.
President of the Commercial Spaceflight Federation, Eric Stalmer, says the spaceflight industry is already looking ahead.
It's a setback, a short-term setback. But Orbital, they have still 4 more launches to go to the International Space Station, and we anticipate those to be a huge success.
However, Orbital Corporation's revenue will suffer, according to John Logsdon of George Washington University's Space Policy Institute.
Because not only was this a major source of revenue for the company, this commercial cargo contract, but we don't know yet how much damage has been done to the launch pad. And it's the only pad from which the Antares vehicle could be launched.
NASA has a similar contract with another private firm, SpaceX Corporation, based in California, and their cargo vehicle is scheduled to launch in December. For now, the U.S. is only sending unmanned flights into space, but that will change. SpaceX and Boeing have both signed contracts with NASA, and manned space flights are planned as soon as 2017. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
Since we'll be talking about timekeeping in a few minutes and the practice of changing time twice a year, this week's Science World Quick Quiz is about time. We've got a quick and simple question for you this week. How many time zones does China currently have? A, 1, B, 5, or C, 10? Think about it and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Scientists have discovered genetic links that could put them closer to finding better treatments for a range of diseases, including multiple sclerosis, juvenile diabetes, lupus, and arthritis. Jessica Berman has this report.
There have been more than 12,000 outbreaks around the world since 1980, affecting 44 million people. The findings are based on information reported to the Global Infectious Disease and Epidemiology Online Network, or GIDEON, an international database that keeps track of outbreaks. It stores information on 215 infectious diseases in 219 countries. Outbreaks of disease that are quickly identified can be treated immediately, and people who are suspected of being infected can be quarantined if necessary. While the number of outbreaks is going up, the good news, according to Sohini Ramachandran, is fewer people are becoming infected today than in the past.
Which might indicate that we are getting better as a society at large in preventing the spread of outbreaks once they start or in identifying outbreaks rapidly.
A Brown University biostatistics expert, Ramachandran, conducted the assessment of GIDEON data along with several colleagues and published their results in the Journal of the Royal Society Interface. Most of the diseases reported to GIDEON, according to Ramachandran, first infected animals, then jumped the species barrier to humans. That's the case with the swine and avian flus and, most recently, the Ebola virus, which is thought to have originated in fruit bats.
When animals are kept in really tight quarters with other animals, anything that's pathogenic among them could spread very rapidly, and then when humans are nearby, that pathogen could evolve to then be transmitted to a human host.
Ramachandran says increasingly dense population centers are setting the stage for a rise in unique disease outbreaks. Researchers were also curious to learn if global warming was causing a rise in the number of infections. Ramachandran says it does not appear so.
We're experiencing a more rich type of set of pathogens as a human species, but overall the burden of infectious disease outbreaks has been decreasing in the recent past.
The top 10 animal-transmitted diseases between 2000 and 2010 were Salmonella, E. coli, Influenza A, Hepatitis A, Anthrax, Dengue Fever, Dysentery, Tuberculosis, Chikungunya, and Trichinosis. So-called zoonotic diseases, according to the report, accounted for 56% of all disease outbreaks since 1980. Examples of human-specific infections included cholera, measles, mumps, and typhoid. The study analyzed data collected between 1980 and 2013. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Researchers at a Midwestern U.S. university found that something called a walking workstation, rather than sitting at a desk, can provide office workers with numerous physical and mental health benefits. With more, here's Science World's Bob Doty.
As a result of the numerous studies that have pointed out the many health risks related to sitting for long periods of time, quite a few office workers, including a number of our colleagues here at VOA, have switched from working at standard sitting workstations to those that allow staff members to work while standing up. Other offices have taken the stand-up workstation a step further and have introduced their staff to something called walking workstations. Instead of just sitting or standing at a desk, the walking workstation comes equipped with a treadmill that can be switched on and off throughout the day so that workers can do a little walking while they work. Researchers from the Department of Psychology in the School of Science at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, have recently conducted a study that found that office workers using walking workstations had a higher level of satisfaction, felt more engaged in their work, and weren't as bored or stressed as those working with standard or sitting workstations. The researchers also found that regardless of a worker's exercise habits or body mass index, the walking workstations provided other significant benefits. Even if a person doesn't exercise or were overweight, that individual will experience both short-term physical and psychological benefits thanks to using the walking workstation. That study can be found online in the American Psychological Association's Journal of Occupational Health Psychology and will be published in the print edition of the journal this coming January. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Let's see if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World quick quiz. We wanted to know, how many time zones does China currently have? A, 1, B, 5, or C, 10? The answer is A. While China spans 5 geographical time zones, it has been observing only one single standard time since the 1949 Chinese Communist Revolution. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
It's a time change weekend here in the United States. On Sunday, November 2nd, people in most of the United States will turn their clocks back 1 hour to switch from daylight saving time to standard time, which will be observed until March of next year. It seems that these biannual time changes have always been accompanied by groans of aggravation and frustration by many people. A lot of people would like to see the practice of time change be completely eliminated. Of these people, some want to observe daylight saving time all year long, while others prefer standard time throughout the year. So, in celebration of the time change, we're going to talk about the history and science of timekeeping and get both sides of the issue of whether we should continue or end the practice of changing time twice a year. First, we spoke with Tom O'Brien, who is the chief of the Time and Frequency Division of the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. Tom tells us that transportation, especially railroads, played a key role in modern timekeeping and establishing the practice of time standards and time zones beginning in the late 1800s.
When transportation used to be by people walking or maybe riding a horse, people kept track of time by looking at the position of the sun, basically. And local noon, wherever you were when the sun was at its highest point in the sky, was fine for keeping time. If it was going to take you 3 or 4 days to get to the next city walking, it didn't really matter that there be synchronization between the time in Revolutionary era New York City and Revolutionary era Philadelphia, because there was no way to instantaneously communicate. But as the railroads came along especially and enabled people to travel at speeds of, 40, 50, 60 miles an hour on average, it became important because to make sure that the railroad time schedules were predictable in different cities when the travel between the cities was pretty fast, you couldn't rely just on local noon. You had to have some kind of standardization of time. And in the United States, it was, in fact, the railroads who first introduced this notion of having standard time and time zones. As travel became even more efficient, especially moving into the era of airplanes in the 20th century and instantaneous communication, the idea of having coordinated time, standard time, rather than each city, each location having its own individual local solar time, became absolutely crucial. Transportation was driving time. And one of the big drivers for even super accurate time today using atomic clocks is this notion of location, transportation, all being monitored by global positioning system, GPS.
Tom, you were talking about the role that railroads play in developing time zones. Let's talk a little bit about that. Now, the world is made up of a number of time zones. First, how many time zones are there around the world, and how is this concept of time zones developed on an international level?
So there are 24 time zones all across the world, and the idea is that within one time zone, all the clocks will be synchronized to that particular time, rather than having a different local time based on the position of the sun, based on solar time. As you can imagine, internationally, it becomes a little more difficult. There really isn't a single body that is responsible for time zones across the world. In the United States, it's the U.S. Department of Transportation that administers time zones, and there's federal law that applies only in the United States about observing time in different time zones. But across the world, it's a little bit more complicated. Bodies like the UN and the International Telecommunications Union, which is a UN-sponsored organization, try to make general guidelines and standards, but of course there's no single body that enforces that. And in fact, when I said there were 24 time zones, let's call that there's 24 quote-unquote standard time zones. In fact, some countries differ by that standard time by 30 minutes. Parts of India and other South Asian countries, even part of Central Australia, actually are differing from the world not by 60 minutes, not by an hour, but by 30 minutes. And that makes it a little more complicated too.
That was Tom O'Brien, who is chief of the Time and Frequency Division of the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology in Boulder, Colorado. Next, Professor Michael Downing from Tufts University tells us that despite the title of his book, Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time, he doesn't really want to see daylight saving time completely go away, but would instead like that the time change revert to the schedule created by the U.S. Congress back in 1966 with the Uniform Time Act, where there was 6 months of daylight saving time and 6 months of standard time.
I think daylight saving time doesn't need to be eliminated. I think we need to get a hold of the Congress to stop expanding the period of it. I think in 1966, when we first got a national policy, Congress got it right. 6 months of daylight so we could enjoy late summer sunsets and 6 months of standard time. But since then, that wise compromise has been compromised out of existence. Clocks have a really limited utility. It's about synchronicity and predictability. So the reason we first adopted a national policy was to make sure, basically, that all our clocks were running on predictable schedules. With Utah considering the exemption, the national policy is at risk again.
Tell us about timekeeping in some of the other countries.
Well, you know, the confusion reigns across the world. Better than half the countries in the world, most of them in the Northern Hemisphere, observe some version of daylight saving time. And though from 1966 for about 40 years, the world was moving toward a uniform period for daylight saving, one of the confusions that came up very recently is when, as a result of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, the United States went from 6 months to 8 months of daylight saving, and only Canada joined us. So we're now off the schedule of the rest of the world. That cost, during the initial change, our airlines alone about $200 million because they had to reschedule all their landings in Europe and in other countries that observe daylight saving. So synchronicity really matters here. Right now, several in the Middle East, including Israel and Iran and other nations, have either ditched daylight saving entirely or decided to turn their clocks ahead a full hour and go on what is essentially full year daylight saving, which of course is just moving your time zone one block to the east. So there's a constant renegotiation with the clocks. You know, once you let people stick their fingers into their clocks, they get the sense that time is malleable. So the idea of continually tooling to try to get the perfect amount of sunlight is something that goes on in every country around the world.
That was Professor Michael Downing from Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. He's also the author of the book, Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. And finally, lawmakers from two U.S. states recently entered the time change debate. While they all agree that the twice-yearly time change has got to go, they disagree with which one to keep and which one should be eliminated. Alabama State Senator Rusty Glover recently said that he's planning to introduce a bill in the state's 2015 legislative session that would have his southern U.S. state observe daylight saving time all year long. But a few weeks ago in Utah, two of its state legislators said that they would rather see standard time instead of daylight saving time be followed throughout the year in their western U.S. state. University of Washington law professor Stephen Calandrillo is on the side of keeping daylight saving time all year long. He wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times back in March that said keeping only daylight saving time would save lives, reduce crime, save energy, and stop Americans from losing sleep each time we switch our clocks. Professor Calandrillo said that what the legislators in Utah are proposing is the opposite of what he thinks should be done.
The problem, though, is that they've gone with exactly the opposite of the correct solution. The correct solution would be to move to year-round daylight savings time because that would save hundreds more lives compared to year-round standard time.
Can you give us a few details of what illustrates that?
The reason why it's important to have year-round daylight savings time is because sunlight is much more important in the afternoon and early evening hours than it is in the morning hours. Around 5 p.m., for example, when you see the switch when you go from daylight savings time to standard time, almost everybody is awake and out and about moving around town. And so traffic fatalities, for example, skyrocket in that hour that goes from sunlight to twilight. And there's everyone in society up and around working at, you know, moving around at 5 p.m., even kids. Whereas at the morning hours, the 7 a.m. hour, because if you move that sunlight permanently into the afternoon, you wind up sacrificing an hour in the morning. It's true, many people are awake and moving around then, but it's far fewer people. And so the studies that I've seen on net would show a net savings of roughly 400 lives per year in terms of reduced traffic fatalities, mostly cars on pedestrians, given the sunlight in the afternoon compared to the sunlight in the morning. Traditionally, by the way, the justification's been energy savings, that you save oil and gas and heating costs having that sunlight available at 5 p.m., again, because everybody is awake and needs energy, whereas at 7 a.m., a lot of people are still sleeping and don't need it as much. That energy savings argument, I've seen some studies even trying to counter that. I still think there is some net energy savings to keeping daylight savings time, but that, in my mind, is only the third most important argument.
That was Stephen Calandrillo, a professor of law at the University of Washington School of Law in Seattle, Washington. So, what do you think? If you live in an area where you must change time twice a year, should the biannual time change continue as it is, or should there be only one form of time all year long? And if you do favor keeping only one time, which one would it be? Daylight saving time or standard time? You decide. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.